Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Catherine Whitlock. She has a PhD in immunology, and she writes about science for numerous magazines and websites. And Dr. Rodri Evans. He has a PhD in astrophysics and also writes about science and is a regular contributor to the BBC on physics and astronomy. We're talking about their new book, 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World, Trailblazers, Pioneers, and Revolutionaries. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to mention the doctor, is it Rodri Evans?
Exactly, Rodri Evans.
Yeah. He's not here, but you've been doing the interviews. Now, this is a fascinating book, and I hate to confess this, but I think I was familiar with three of these people. And
that's quite good.
Is it? Because I felt quite embarrassed. Although I was familiar with the research that they did. How did you get it down to 10 women?
Well, that's a great question. It was difficult, even in the relatively small pool of female scientists, historical female scientists. So we had a few criteria. One of the principal ones is that we wanted a nice round number of 10 because the kind of length of book that this is, it allowed us to go into a bit of depth about their lives, both their family lives and their science, and they were very much intertwined. So we wanted that level of detail. And the other key thing is that we were trying to get a balance of different sciences. You know, these women worked in all kind of different fields. And that's very important because one of the functions we hope of this book is to inspire young girls and young women to work in science. And there are areas of science that are still poorly represented by the female part of the population. So things like physics in particular.
I was going to say,
It was very important to make sure we had some of them in. But again, my background is in biology, biomedical research, and so I wanted to get some of those in. So it was difficult. We had to leave some women out, but that's the nature of the game, really.
How about researching the details of their life? I noticed that in every single essay, you have all these details about their upbringing and stuff like that. How hard was that to find that out?
Yeah, so we went back to primary sources for some of it, and we relied on interviews and a lot of stuff is out there. There is a certain number of books written about these women in very different contexts. So we drew on all kinds of sources to bring it together as a complete picture of who they were. It was a lot of fun, actually, and there's an awful lot we had to leave out, which is a shame. But, yeah.
Now, the women all chosen are dead. And what's the reason for that? Because I know an awful lot of contemporary women scientists.
There are. And in many ways, you could argue that's a criticism of the book, but I also think it's a strength because the reason for choosing women who are dead is that it provides that kind of context. Many of them were not, they're not fully recognized now, and they certainly weren't at the time.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I know.
And we tried in each chapter to give some sense of where things have gone since they were working in the field. And you can't do that with people who are living now. They may have made amazing discoveries, but particularly in the kind of possibly slightly more esoteric, pure science areas, it's difficult to realize what the research that's happening now is precisely going to lead to. And, these women encountered all sorts of difficulties, but one thing that was quite common to all of them is they had a certain amount of freedom in their research. That was a real upside of their time. I've worked in medical research. I know what it's like. You have to justify what you're doing all the time, rightly so in many ways. But these women worked at a time where they didn't have to in quite the same way.
But there was a downside of that too.
Yeah, of course, because, it was incredibly difficult for many of them.
Oh, my God. One example stood out in this book that just Rita Levi Montalcini.
Montalcini.
Yeah. Oh, my God. She's trying to do research while sort of secretly hiding out from the fascists in Italy and then the Nazis. And so bombs are falling all over the place. She's doing surreptitious research. And at one point, it gets down to she's in a corner in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, in her bedroom. She sets up a secret lab in her bedroom. And, I love that story because There was a lot of information about her because she was the longest living of our scientists. She lived till she was 103, and she was an absolute force for good in science. And she worked in the field of neurobiology, so she was trying to work out how nerve cells grow and how they develop in the embryo at a very early stage of life. And so she was working away in Fascist Italy, you know, hidden from view, and she was working with chick embryos using eggs from the local farmyard and tools from the optician and all sorts of weird, you know, anywhere she could find something to work with, she could. And everything was so scarce that even, much to the horror of her family, when she'd finished with the eggs, they all had to eat them.
When I read that, I
was so scarce.
Oh, my God. I don't know any other scientist that's gone through that. And the amazing thing is she succeeded.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she had her real ups and downs. She discovered the first growth factor, so these tiny molecules that drive the development of various cells in the body at different times, including the embryo. And she discovered the first known one called nerve growth factor, which, you know, it says as it does on the tin, it drives the growth of nerve cells. But nobody could quite believe her. It kind of went against a lot of the thinking at the time, and she got quite disheartened and actually shelved that research for a while and then thought, hey, I think I really have found something amazing. I'm going to come back to it. And, you know, it all took off from there. So She was an incredible woman, incredible.
Well, and that's one thing I found common among all the 10 women here, that they're amazingly driven and focused. And like from an early age, they showed an aptitude for science or sort of scientific thinking, and then really went about it no matter what, no matter who told them. And they were sort of all born within 50 years of each other. And for women to get their advanced degrees in science was just not a common thing at that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I only really realized it after we'd written the book, but one of the things the book does is it shows the characteristics that you need to succeed in life in a very heightened and focused way, because, and in, not only in science, you know, in all areas of life, if you like, because these women had such a tough time in A, getting educated, and B, finding and working in science, finding jobs and working in science, it really shows what's necessary to succeed. They all had these characteristics that were running through. I always use the analogy of a stick of rock. I don't know if you have rock in the States, but when you go onto a seaside resort in this country, you buy a stick of rock. There's all the nasty, sugary stuff, and it has the name of the place running all the way through it. Huh. And that's the analogy I use. You know, the characteristics, this tenacity, use of, you know, making the most of every opportunity, finding a mentor that will work with you, or a partner, that it runs through all these women like the name of a seaside town through a stick of rock.
It's amazing some of what these women went through. Dorothy Hodgkin, she had a marriage, she had three children. Now, not all these women had a permanent partner, but the amazing thing is she suffered critical arthritis. And literally had to work through that. I mean, there were times when she could not turn on the buttons because of her. And she was doing X-ray crystallography, very critical research on discovering the structure of things like penicillin. And she was so crippled with arthritis, she had to have one of her coworkers like customize the machinery so that she could turn it on.
No. She's and of course this is in the days before there was any treatment for things like rheumatoid arthritis. So she just pushed on through it. And she was diagnosed with it quite young, I think, certainly around the age she was beginning to have children. And she just pushed through it. And there's a photograph or there's a painting. I think we didn't include it in the book, but there's a lovely painting of her by Anna Hamlin, I think is her name, that hangs in the National Portrait Gallery here in London. And it really epitomizes what she was about. Her hands were totally gnarled, but the portraiture shows the hands kind of shaking in a kind of frenzy of activity. And she's hunched over a desk with these lovely structures of these crystals of penicillin and so on in front of her. And it just completely epitomizes what she was about, kind of. I mean, I use the word frenzied. She wasn't really a frenzied woman. She was very calm in many ways. But, again, she had this persistence that she just kept at it. Still found time for her children. I mean, that was a lovely thing. And there are one or two lovely quotes, which, I'm a mother of three children. I've worked in science all my life. So I really, I'm nothing like the same league as her, but I identified with the challenges. And one of her co-workers, there are some lovely quotes from people who worked with her, but one of them, I think actually it was Kathleen Lonsdale, who was also a famous chemist and X-ray crystallographer, and she said, what amazes me about Dorothy is she always found time for the children. She never fussed about the little things, but, she would drop anything to help out the child. And then she also had this amazing ability just to switch back, just to switch her brain set from worrying about the children and sorting out the children to back to her detailed research. So a lesson for us all.
She's also an incredibly brilliant person. I mean, she was one of the, she used computers early on. Help solve some of the problems. X-ray crystallography is a very difficult branch of science, and she's using computers.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, she was an early exponent of the use of computers in science, but despite that, it still took something like 30 years to discover the structure of insulin. 30 years! I mean, the sort of research that she was doing, it would now take, I don't know, 3 weeks, that kind of time frame, magnitude of difference is unbelievable. But again, and actually one of the incredible things about her is that she also shows the importance, even in this day and age when everyone's a specialist, of thinking outside the box and being a bit of a polymath. So she started out her life in the Sudan. Her father was working there, and she spent a lot of time on archaeological digs with him and became fascinated by the intricate patterns in tiles on all these places they went to. And years later, that intuitive sense of patterns and the layouts and the relationships between different areas of these patterns fed through into her research when she was interpreting these very complicated X-ray images of the structure of molecules. So I just love the idea that drawing patterns on an archaeological dig could years later feed into this. Incredible.
She was also a big proponent of internationalism in science, too.
Yes.
And devoutly anti-war.
Yes, exactly. I mean, she worked in Cambridge University, where she spent much of her working life in the 1930s, was a very left-wing environment, actually. Her and her husband had strong communist leanings, and in fact, there's a debate as to how much she understood about what was going on in Russia at the time with Stalin and so on, or leading up to Stalin. But she was absolutely adamant that the lines of communication needed to be kept open between communist China and communist Russia. And that was a large part of her success and the success of scientists around her, that she pushed those boundaries and just kept the lines of communication open. So I think, again, many of these stories show you that science doesn't operate in a vacuum. You have to be very aware of the social context of the science that you're doing and the implications of your science.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Catherine Whitlock. She has a PhD in immunology. She writes a lot about science for numerous magazines and websites. And with Dr. Rodri Evans, she's written a book. It's wonderful reading. 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World, Trailblazers, Pioneers, and Revolutionaries. Catherine, I have to mention, because this is a person who's been a big influence on my life, and that's Rachel Carlson.
Yeah.
The biologist, environmental conservationist. It's interesting. You talked about people switching fields. She started out doing a lot of oceanography and marine biology. It sort of seemed like that was her passion in her books, Edge of the Sea. And she also has a lot to do with where I'm talking with right now. She did a lot of work at Woods Hole. She used to muck around up in Plum Island. But then she started to work on the problems with DDT. How did she get started on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think she worked for one of the government agencies. Like many of these women, she struggled with getting a job and earning enough to live, basically. She was funding herself for most of her research, and she worked for, I've forgotten the name of it right now, but she worked for one of the government agencies where she was producing bulletins, not only on the state of the marine environment, but also on the environment generally. And she was constantly, you know, I suppose when you work for a government agency, you're constantly getting material on your desk, which reveals, you know, potential dangers. And she was very alert to the use of pesticides and insecticides, and partly relates also to her upbringing. She lived near Pittsburgh, which was at the time, and possibly still is, was an industrial center.
Yep.
And she was very aware of the pollution. They could probably smell the smoke from the factories where she lived on the farm. And this kind of fed through, this exposure on a daily basis in her work, and her, the back of her mind, what she'd been seeing, really fed through into investigating much more thoroughly. And she was probably a marine biologist first and foremost, but she was also a very detailed investigator. Again, she just always kept at it, delved into the information that was available and coming to her. And I think, I mean, what's the other fascinating thing about her is that she is probably the only one of our 10 scientists who really got her message across at the time, I think, to the general public.
Right, right.
And one of the reasons for that is that she wrote so beautifully. That, you know, the language is probably quite different to what we'd use nowadays, but the message was there, and the science behind it was accurate and still is. And in fact, I think she majored in English because she'd written all her life stories often about the environment around her, but very, very beautiful descriptions of what she saw and what she witnessed. And that really fed through and opened up, I think, probably a large section of the population who wouldn't necessarily have read that kind of material. It was serialized.
Well, she was criticized for writing popular books. Like The Sea Around Us. I grew up, and The Sea Around Us was a best-selling book.
But
she got criticized from the scientific community for sort of writing that.
Yeah, in that style, because it's not the way that most scientists write. Much more descriptive. But you know, I think the important thing is the science is there and it is accurate. I think she was justified, and she was justified because it woke up everybody. I mean, she is credited, I think, quite rightly, as being one of the forerunners of the environmental movement.
But like,
and it went all the way to the top. Yeah.
She was also hampered by ill health. And when Silent Spring was published, God, was there a backlash from the chemical industry. I mean, she really faced tremendous backlash in her lifetime.
Exactly. And by that time, she was ill with terminal cancer. So it was having to deal with that as well as all the publicity. And you know, she was accused of all sorts of things, communist conspiracy against, you know, capitalism, and endless, completely unfounded and inaccurate claims. And I think, you know, she stands out, obviously, as one of the more well-known scientists that we've covered. But her work is incredible.
I also, there's so many people, so many of these scientists, I loved learning about their life. Virginia Apgar. What a nice person. She developed a new field, obstetric anesthetics, but more importantly, she developed the Apgar test. What is that?
Yeah. So the Apgar test, I mean, I like you, even though I am a scientist, was not aware of many of these women. The research, yes, but not the women. And I, as a mother, was aware of the Apgar technique. So when a baby is born, and this is used worldwide now, there are five indicators of their well-being, and they're very, very simple tests. The medics measure, you know, their muscle tone and their pulse and their appearance and how they're breathing. And there are these five very, very simple tests, incredibly easy to do. But she discovered at the time that she developed this test that essentially the babies were kind of ignored when they were born.
Yeah.
All the focus was on the mother. And the babies were just put on one side, you know, maybe wrapped up in a cot. Nobody paid them much attention. And, you know, this would literally lead to a number of deaths because they were suddenly struggling to breathe. And the simple kind of aspiration or some extra oxygen or kind of steps that needed to be taken weren't happening. And she was horrified by this. She said, obviously, the mother's important, but we need to keep an eye on the baby as well. And from that, all sorts of new innovations happened in neonatal medicine, that, you know, the development of intensive care units for babies and, you know, early intervention, any kind of issues. So very, very simple test, but something that really revolutionized neonatology.
She was known for her bedside manner, too. And she worked, there's an organization here, March of Dimes, which is well known to the people here who are listening. She worked with them, too. I mean, she really worked hard to deal with what were called birth defects, premature. Yeah. She worked a lot to prevent premature births. What an amazing person.
Yeah, no, she was fantastic. And the March of Dimes thing is incredible because she was fantastic at raising money. And that's really, you know, what that came down to. And that was to ensure that the polio vaccine had a proper cover across the whole of the states, and people sent in a dime and raised enough money to fund this campaign. I love that story because it just shows the power of one person to drive something so fundamental and so important.
We only have a few minutes left, and I just want to mention one more person who I found was a favorite of mine, Elsie Whittison.
Yeah. She's probably not well known by many people.
No, I had no idea who she was.
Yeah. So she's a, we featured a wealth of nationalities. She was one of the British scientists that we featured. And she was a pioneer in the field of nutrition. In particular, understanding, A, the composition of foods. Her and her partner, McCants, developed this huge compendium that literally broke down every foodstuff into all its components and its constituents. But more importantly, here in the UK, she developed the wartime diet in World War II and beyond. Rationing was a huge thing. And she and McCants worked out between them how much you needed to eat. And not only did they work it out, what was the minimum amount of bread or eggs or meat or whatever it was that one needed to live. They tested it by hill walking.
I love that.
Love that. And also, it wasn't only that. She injected herself with various things, totally against any kind of modern-day understanding of health and safety. Trace elements to see what effect they had on the body, you know, often with quite devastating effects when they weren't pure compounds.
But this idea of like learning about the carbohydrate and sugar contents of food, it really goes back to her, like trying to figure out what's in all the food.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at the back of any foodstuff, the packet in the supermarket, those kind of measurements are derived from the work that they did.
That's right.
To understand exactly what's in them. And of course, the conditions in those days, you know, we're going back to the 30s and 40s, working in labs, and they were dealing with vast vats of, you know, really unpleasant kind of boiling liquids. And, you know, all sorts of stories of kind of, working out what the fat composition of seal pups and the milk that's
she became fascinated by milk of other animals and did all this research on it.
So, you know, all those sort of freezers full of, you know, really unspeakable specimens.
But she did, she also worked on a very critical thing. At the end of World War II, there was a question about the diet to rehabilitate concentration camp survivors. She worked on that.
Yeah, no, that's right. And not only those, children in orphanages, that's the story that really sticks in my mind. Orphanages in Germany who were often very, very undernourished. And again, she worked out a diet that would slowly rehabilitate these children. And she discovered that it was working incredibly well in one orphanage and not in the other. And it was exactly the same diet, similar age children and all the rest of it, lots of controlled experiments, but she discovered after a long process of investigation that the big difference between them is that the staff who ran the orphanage where the children were doing less well were much less loving, and that was feeding through to the way these children metabolized the food and prospered. So there were all sorts of spin-offs from her research that revolutionized that field of nutrition, absolutely.
Now, We just have like 1 minute left. Of the 10 women here, what was the one that surprised you the most that you felt, I'm really glad I learned that story?
Yeah. Oh, that's almost impossible because I think it would apply to all of them. I think...
You must have done some of these before, some of these people.
Yeah, no, I did. My background's in biology and chemistry, so several of them were well known to me. I think Rita Levi-Montalcini I often quote because...
Oh, wow.
It's partly because she lived so long. And so by virtue of her long life, 103 years on this planet, she achieved an awful lot. She never stopped working. And there's a lovely story that you would only ever recognize the Pope, the head of the Catholic Church, if she was standing next to Rita. Which sums her up so well. Yeah.
You know, actually, that seems to be a common element to all these women is they worked hard as long as they possibly could.
Yeah, because science was their love. You know, their work was their love. It's like they say, if you're doing a job you love, you're not really going to work. And I think that's, I mean, don't get me wrong, they had immense trials and tribulations. but I think that's the heart of it. They were doing something they loved.
This is going to be a weird question, but is there going to be another 10?
Oh, yeah. Well, I would... My field of research that I worked in for years is immunology. And immunology is such a burgeoning field. There's so much about the immune system and new cancer treatments and stuff. And there are a number of very influential immunologists, female immunologists. So I'd like to do one on 10 female immunologists.
Just 10 female immunologists?
Yeah. And you could do that. You could do that now. Living.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm on. My guest tonight has been Catherine Whitlock. She has a PhD in immunology, and she also writes about science for numerous magazines and websites. And with Dr. Audrey Evans, they've written a wonderful book, and it's really an inspiring book and fascinating book to learn about how these people worked. 10 women who changed science and the world, trailblazers, pioneers, and revolutionaries. Catherine, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.